Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 361. Welcome back to the program. Not much going on in the news. I did go ahead and I just wrote a new piece on the Midnight Freemasons, and it's titled The Truth About Esoteric Masonry and Traditional Observance. I hope you guys all check that out. It's on midnightfreemasons.com. It was the article that just went up this past Friday, so that would have been September 7th. This week on the program, I am super excited. We have an interview with Brother Jamie Paul Lamb, who wrote a new book called Myth, Magic, and Masonry, Occult Perspectives in Freemasonry. We've got a great interview coming right up in just a moment. The Whence Came You podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Masonic Revival, contemporary Masonic designs made for today's Freemason. You don't have to settle for throwing a plain old square and compass on anything anymore. Now you get something truly designed and truly wonderful. Whether it's aprons, awesome pins, and wonderful neckwear, bow ties, ties, pocket squares, you name it, Masonic Revival has it. Head on over to MasonicRevival.com and check out what they have to offer. And make sure if you see Brother Edgar, tell him thanks for helping bring this program to all of you. And this program is also brought to you by all of you, those of you who support this program. We can't do it without you and your donations and all of your assistance, so thank you so much. To find out more about how you can assist this program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. There you can make direct donations, sign up to be a monthly contributor, a fellow, or even a producer. And thanks very much to everybody for donating. All right, everybody, we're back this week. We are lucky to have the author of a brand new book that's come out. It's called Myth, Magic, and Masonry. And in Myth, Magic, and Masonry, we have Brother Jamie Paul Lamb, who develops four thought-provoking interpretations of the symbolism and allegorical content of Freemasonry and some of its appendant bodies. By viewing the craft through the interpretive lenses of ceremonial magic, solar and astrological lore, and symbolism, classical mythology, and the Roman mystery cult, Mithraism, Lamb establishes four distinct vantage points from which to survey Freemasonry. Thereby, Jamie Paul Lamb enables Masons, new and old, to develop a more nuanced appreciation of the craft and a deeper understanding of the fraternity's priceless initiatory heritage. So, Brother Jamie Paul Lamb, welcome to the show.
Brother Robert Johnson, it is a pleasure and an honor to be on your show. I'm a big fan.
Thanks so much. I want to say congratulations on your book, first and foremost. Is this your first published book?
This is. Up till now, I've only had articles published in Knight Templar Magazine, Royal Arch Masons, Connecticut Freemasons Magazine, and a few other publications, and online.
Right on.
This is my first full work for a published book.
Well, congratulations. It is quite the accomplishment. But before we go and we tell you where to buy the book and all this stuff, I have to ask, where's your home lodge and where are you based out of?
Well, my mother lodge is back in Connecticut, where I'm from, and I'm still dues current there. I plan to stay that way. That's St. John's Old Well Number 6, Norwalk, Connecticut, FNAM. My affiliate lodges in the Phoenix area, where I've lived for the last 4 or 5 years, are Arizona Number 2, Phoenix, Arizona, of course, and Ascension Lodge Number 89, which is, we just got our charter. So that was a lodge we started from the ground up.
Well, congratulations. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, we've been doing this sort of Masonic Restoration Foundation model. I hesitate to call it a TO lodge, but we don't mind the term observant lodge.
Right on, yeah. I think that's a very popular concept that's come a long way and super important in relation to how we respect the fraternity. And it's not too far to say that there are those Masons who are looking for something a little bit more symbolic, something a little bit more interpretive of our questions on spirituality. And I'll use the term occultism, but in its original context, right? Like the mysteries. So congratulations.
Oh, yeah, I don't shy away from that term. You know, occult meaning hidden. And, you know, we say the first petition I signed at my mother lodge said, I am signing this petition for the hidden mysteries of Freemasonry.
Exactly.
And when I read that, I sort of knew that I was in the right place.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of guys read that and they get into that, and then the mysteries are why it actually takes 6 meetings to change out a toilet seat.
Exactly. Yeah. Get a lot of that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, congratulations on the lodge and the book. First and foremost, let me ask, what got you interested in what I will deem the occult side of the mysteries?
That happened actually before I petitioned a lodge. There had been sort of a process of refinement that I've been undergoing for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years before that. And as is a lot of other people's sort of introduction to the world of the Western esoteric tradition, I had the good fortune of coming into a copy of Manly P. Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages, which, of course, I understand now is, I could take or leave about 25% of it, but I think it still holds water for being at least a sort of cursory compendium of the general scope of the occult. And that sort of led me to, really before I was halfway through with that book, I knew that my projected course going forward would definitely be becoming a Freemason and using that as my foundation. What really sort of helped to buttress that idea, or the developments that I made, are really represented in the book, in that I started writing right away. I pretty much used writing as a way to suss things out and get my head around certain concepts. Obviously, when we go through something like the second section of the third degree, which of course I'm not going to talk about in detail, when we go through something like that, it was my experience that, okay, there's a lot going on here for this just to be about, you know, learning when to keep your mouth shut and to, you know, hold in a secret. There's obviously something of immense antiquity going on here. There are certainly many tributaries to our ritual and our symbolism. You know, in fact, I found, in my research at least, I'm finding that these, you know, the lineal sort of ancestors of our ritualism and symbolism disappear in the mists of history. And sometimes these may not be unbroken lineages per se, but certainly the overarching concepts and some general motifs we could trace back until literally prehistory. I mean, if you read something like Van Gennep's Rites of Passage, or you'll see that these quote-unquote primitive tribal cults and secret societies in the anthropological sense find that there's just a lot of common motifs. So getting back to the occult, I sort of always used that comparative methodology in my research and my way of understanding comparative mythology, comparative religion. It's an interest of mine. So developing these analogies, particularly vis-a-vis the occult and the general body of esoterica, Hermeticism, Kabbalah, these have proven for me to be advantageous sort of vantage points from which to survey the craft.
Absolutely. I love that you're talking about the idea of comparative religions, because comparative religions, as that exists right now, the student of the comparative religion will take note the first time they have an aha moment when something is revealed to them that there is a common thread throughout all of these things, or sometimes I'll even call it a dogma, right, that is traced all the way back. Now, one of the things I saw, you know, in the description of your book, it talks about astrological, and so much of everything, if not everything, traces back to, from my research, I'm also very big into comparative religions, but traces back to the precession and solar alignment, basically astronomical and solar viewing. And what's interesting is we have all of these archetypes that go throughout each system, throughout ages, that really seem to tie everything together, but people don't dive that deep into these things. And it sounds like you've done with this work. Something else I find fascinating about what you've decided to talk about is that you've referenced the mysteries, and that is something else that I study very heavily, what we will call earliest recorded and verifiable mystery schools that have existed, things like Dionysian Rite or the Eleusinian Rites, which really, from my understanding, and if you've gone deeper and you know more about this, please enlighten us, but from those aspects, those were said to have come from an earlier time, from Egypt. And so we're taking those from then, and we're coming through the Grecian schools, and the similar thread through all of those seems to be what we kind of practice as a culmination of a third degree in almost a gentleman's society. Would you agree with those statements?
I do, yeah. Certainly I've corroborated that in my research, and, you know, I gotta say that it couldn't have been more than maybe a month after my being raised to the degree of Master Mason that I got a copy of Robert Hewitt Brown's Stellar Theology and Masonic Astronomy.
Holy cow, you dove right in.
And, you know, it was a cheap Kessinger that I found online. I was just trying to support certain ideas that were, you know, just trying to make sense of what was going on.
Yep.
And to develop these analogous or, you know, comparative perspectives. And I got to tell you that about halfway through that book, it was one of those things where, like, you know, you're watching The Sixth Sense and then all of a sudden you realize Bruce Willis has been dead the whole time. It was that same sort of mind-blowing, like, oh my God, this is the astrological keys to our, and solar keys to our symbolism and ritualism. Just, you know, it's so developed and so pervasive in everything that we do. I mean, I wouldn't call it the end-all, be-all interpretive scope, but I would say that that is a valuable perspective to have when we begin to suss out not only the origins, but how to appreciate our symbolism going forward. And certainly bringing that into the Royal Arch and the rest of the council and the consistory and certain degrees of Scottish Rite ritualism, definitely into the Rosicrucian College. I'm a member of the Arizona Societas Rosicruciana to do the hard C thing. And I find that perspective, a developed solar and astrological perspective on the craft has provided at least one vantage point to filter into a greater view of the craft as a whole.
Fascinating. So what was your favorite part about this book to write?
I think my favorite part, and maybe what is hopefully perhaps an unprecedented offering, I didn't read this in Robert Hewitt Brown. I don't believe it's in there. This is among what is hopefully 5 to 10 unprecedented observations, or at least I haven't been able to find a precedent in our literature. So hopefully I'm bringing some new perspectives to our work. The one that I think a lot of my theses in here sort of hinges upon is using the Anna Lucas as that temporal perspective. So that's 4000 BCE, right?
Yep.
Because we're in 6018 now. So 4000 BCE, at that point, you find that the vernal equinox was occurring in the house of Taurus. So it was what you mentioned, precession earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Due to axial precession, that would have been the Taurian age. So you'll notice on the cover of my book, there's a minotaur against the wheel of the zodiac. And that I chose, of course, to illustrate a point that I think weaves through each of my four sections there. So the ceremonial magic section, the solar and astrological section, of course, the mythological section, and the section of Mithraism due to the Tauroctony, and that being perhaps, having its origins as a mystery cult, maybe in its Persian or Indian form during the Taurian age. And of course, you know, Minoan culture, which
I was going to say, are you going to bring up the Minoan culture? Because when you talk about, you know, the sun rising in the age of Taurus, immediately my mind goes to the Minoan culture and some of the research that I've read about what we'll call not fringe scientists, but scientists who want to believe, right? They are the ufologists, right? I want to believe, but it's Atlantis, right? Where they want to place the Minoan culture and the Atlantean culture together, which I think is interesting, but I digress. Carry on, please.
You know, bringing that up, I think we need, sometimes the avant-garde in research doesn't come from established academia. I mean, new ideas don't always form inside of the established paradigm. So I think that we need people who are like the Graham Hancocks or the John Anthony Wests or the Robert Schocks of the world to kind of at least bring up challenging ideas. So if they're not completely tenable, they're at least something that might spur on some research that put some pieces together that we're not likely to find in the closed circuit of academia. And taking that as a sort of jumping off point without getting too crazy. I mean, I cited all of my sources in here. Some of them are secondary just in terms of academic honesty. For instance, if I got something from Pico de Mirandola, I don't want to attribute that necessarily to the ancient fragment, hermetic fragment, when, you know, I got that second or third hand. I wanted to show the lineage where I got these academic or the lineage in the literature, because sometimes there are developments, there are variations on the themes that we bring up that citing a secondary or a tertiary source sometimes speaks to the evolution of that idea. Just as, you know, we brought up Robert Hewitt Brown already, and he's certainly not the first one to find stellar lore to be at the heart of certain mythological ideas. He's not the first one to necessarily bring it up vis-a-vis Freemasonry. So I know Pike talks about it, and I believe, and I'm sure Pike, having cribbed Eliphas Levy so much, you know, who knows if we get it from Kenneth MacKenzie, Eliphas Levy. There's a lot of it that obviously came through Agrippa and people like that. So I think it's important to show the lineage. I digressed a little bit. But
no, I think that's really an important point, because I have been asked on a number of occasions to give a presentation on something. And on occasion, I will have to go out and I'll present to a group of Masons, not on something that is my bread and butter, right? It'll be on how to do research. And within that presentation, I talk a lot about citing our sources and the value of doing that, because it's kind of like, in this day and age, if you're arguing with somebody via social media, let's say Facebook, if you misspell a word, you are completely invalidated. This same
for sure. Yeah, can you believe it?
I know. It's like, oh, I didn't put a comma in there, so I've changed the entire meaning. It's like, read past that. But in the academic sense, the same is true with academia. And it's, if you want to put a book out there and cite something that is, I'm going to use air quotes and say, insane, and it becomes insane because we haven't cited it. But the second you put some weight behind it, some academic weight behind it, like who wrote it originally or whose idea this could have come from, or all of the clues to where, you know, we're pulling the information from, now all of a sudden it's not so crazy. And this is one of the greatest things. You mentioned Graham Hancock earlier. Most of his work, if not all of it, is really well researched and well documented where he gets his information from. And if he doesn't cite it in the book, he tells you right in the text line, Hamlet's Mill. You know, I mean, the guy writes so much about Hamlet's Mill in almost all of his books, but man, like, you know where that book comes from. And there's so much value there. And I have to thank you, because as somebody who is into the quote-unquote fringe side of Masonry, the occultism, esoteric thoughts, and, you know, I have volumes on many different occult topics, some of which are Masonic, some of which are not, there is a tremendous value there in citing a professional, citing somebody in academia, or at least even citing where it came from in its genesis to where it is now. Like you said, you talked about kind of tracing a lineage. So thank you so much for doing that extra work. It is not easy to do, but thanks for tracing your steps.
Yeah, I think it's important to be able to corroborate the information. And again, that reminds me of a story. Rex Hutchins lives in Tucson, Arizona. He comes up to Phoenix relatively frequently. One time we were in a research lodge together, and the organizer of that research lodge, who was sort of organizing the events and the presentations, was asking Rex to do a debate about a certain subject. I don't remember what. That's not important. But he asked Rex, which side do you want? And Rex was like, just tell me which side you want me on. And you know, Rex Hutchins supports every idea that he has. I mean, if you look through his work, I mean, everything is just, I mean, it's rock solid work. So for him to say that got me thinking, you know, even if you've got a crazy idea, or let's say an avant-garde idea, or something that's, as we said, outside of the paradigm of what's established, you know, what we know, you could pretty much find a source to support anything. And if people don't go down the rabbit hole of your sources, I mean, you can hope that they do. I mean, you hope that they try to at least come into it with an open mind. As we said, sometimes these fringy ideas, these avant-garde ideas, just because they're new or they're outside of what we can say we know for sure or what's supported in the literature, doesn't mean that they don't merit our investigation. Look at, I'm good friends with P.D. Newman. His Alchemically Stoned Psychedelic Secret of Freemasonry came out about a year ago. Same imprint as my book. How could anybody have missed that idea, you know, about the Acacia? I won't get into his whole thesis. It's really hard to go through our literature and find ideas that haven't been picked over already with a fine-tuned comb. You know, it's hard to get a novel idea. I like to think that I have maybe 10 novel ideas in here. Granted, they're not massive like Newman's. I mean, they're not these big that weave through everything, but just a couple that are unique perspectives that, as I said, I can't find a precedent for. So these are the sort of things that otherwise I wouldn't want to put out a book. You know, if I was, if it were just a sort of research book, maybe a historical piece would be fine, but if it were just my musings on what I think about Freemasonry or what an opinion piece or something like that, I wouldn't be interested in putting that out into the world. I wouldn't feel personally comfortable with that. So I wanted to present an argument that, like, one of my big ones is ceremonial magic and Freemasonry being sort of integral to each other. Like, the modern idea of ceremonial magic, you just simply would not have that without Freemason, because for a second, look at that little lineage, right? So you get Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia, which then Mathers and Westcott and Woodman go on to form the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. They codified, you know, a certain set of rituals and symbolism based on cipher manuscripts, and they gave it a Masonic foundation. They, through Masonic research like theirs, we literally get what we know of as ceremonial magic today, and it just would not be the case without that. There would be. Now, here's the sort of fringy element maybe in my book, is that I argue also the inverse argument to that, or that Freemasonry in our, let's say, the blue degrees, we do invocations, we do banishings. There are nods to certain Solomonic and the VSL, the Volume of Sacred Law, as a grimoire. What is a grimoire? It's a compendium of rituals, operations, and invocation. We're using the, let's say, the narrative of King Solomon's Temple as a basis for our ritualism. So how is the VSL not a grimoire at that point? If we're using it in this transformative ritual, right, and we're using that as our template for the operation at hand, the, let's say, a magical operation at hand, causing change in conformity with the will as a, let's say, a working definition of magic. It's a pretty popular definition. So to have these sort of things, and like we talked about, the blatant hermeticism in Freemasonry, the relationship, and, you know, that's most strongly represented in the relationship between the microcosm and the macrocosm. We say in our lectures that the lodge room is symbolic of the universe, right? It's a model of the universe. We say that it's a microcosm of that. I forget the exact wording. I think you know the part I'm talking about.
I do, and if we have any grand lecturers out there listening, don't write me hate mails in quoting it, because I know you know it already.
Right. It's but, something like, what are the dimensions of the lodge?
Exactly, yeah. Well, one of the things that you talked about there that really struck a chord is you said, we're doing magic, we're doing these ceremonies. And I will tell you, and I know you know this, but so many guys, if we were to tell them that, all of a sudden, now it's crazy. Now it's not an organization that they want to be a part of. That's not what they joined. But it's like, I feel like, well, I hate to break it to you, but that is what it is on this kind of occult level. You know, you said we're purging a lodge. That's what the circumambulation is doing at parts in the ritual. Every little bit of our ritual is actually designed to be doing something that is very spiritual, that goes beyond Now, I think there's a reason why Masonry, in my opinion, doesn't have a set dogma. I mean, here in the U.S. or mostly around the world, in large part, except for, I think, some elements in Sweden, right, where you have to be Christian. But in most of the world, there's no religion attached to Freemasonry. And I think that's pretty key, especially when we consider maybe that's by design in this particular way, because it's cutting through the dogma of those things to the heart of what's supposed to happen, a real change to kind of wake the sleeper. I don't know if that's too Frank Herbert, Dune, the sleeper must awaken type stuff, but it's interesting that you bring that up.
It makes sense to me. I mean, and if you look at things that happen throughout our ritualism, and hopefully I've pointed out many of those. So this is, I'll just say that this is probably my biggest contribution to Masonic literature, is that particular thesis about highlighting those motifs, common motifs between ceremonial magic and Freemasonry. That, like, for instance, you're led into the lodge room, you're asked to invoke the blessings of deity. Okay? So deity, at this point, we don't, by saying a supreme being, we don't necessarily, I mean, look at the volumes of sacred law on the altar. We don't necessarily, we have seven on ours at Ascension Lodge. We have a Zendavesta, we have Mahabharata or a Bhagavad Gita, you know, we have several volumes of sacred law on there, and we invoke the blessings of deity, and at what point is the deity that we're invoking the egregore of the lodge? Now, the egregore is, of course, an occult concept widely referenced in magical literature and in ceremonial magic. So, you know, another thing is this. You mentioned the circumambulation. Of course, there are magical circles that demarcate the area of the operation. You see this a lot in Goetic magic, or it's in one of the Claviculi, Solomonic keys. And these sorts of operations, in addition to all the hermetic elements, we can go through the officer's jewels, as I do in section 3, the mythological section, and I point out the senior deacon as the psychopompos, right? He's the psychopomp. He's the guide through the thonic underworld. So low 12 being perhaps the, well, you've read Robert Hewitt Brown. So there again, we're back in the solar and astrological.
Yep.
You know, we're at the winter solstice. So if you see the wheel of the zodiac, and here's the other thing, we started talking about it earlier, how you get the fixed signs of the zodiac, which are Leo, Taurus, Scorpio, and Aquarius, right? Let me say Taurus first. Taurus in the vernal equinox through the Anno Lucas, right, 4000 BCE, Taurus would have been the vernal equinox. Leo would have been at the summer solstice, so the royal arch in the heavens where the sun is at is the beauty and glory of the day.
Correct.
The sun is at the height. What grip do we use to raise the candidate into that exalted station? So, and then over to the Scorpio, alternately known as the eagle or the phoenix. Okay, so the bull, the lion, the eagle, and the man being Aquarius, the water bearer, down in the winter solstice, low 12. So, if we could see that wheel, and if we could see that particular quaternary at 4000 BCE and use that as the temporal reference point, that particular stage in axial precession, then we see that it fits our ritualism and helps to decode our symbolism. Look at the Royal Arch. The banner on the Royal Arch has the tetramorph. The tetramorph, of course, is from Ezekiel's vision and John the Revelator's vision. You'll see that they had four faces, that of an ox, a lion, an eagle, and a man.
Yep.
And they had four faces in one. And
yeah, it's referenced in Ezekiel.
Exactly. Wheels within wheels. So that's why I put the Minotaur on the cover. Minoan civilization, and the fact that this Taurian age configuration weaves through all of my subjects here. The Tauroctony and Mithraism. If you look at the Tauroctony, I'm sure you're familiar, you study the mystery cults. So you'll see that Mithras, let's call him a solar anthropomorphization at this point, right, is on top of the bull, slaying the bull. So that could be construed as the sun having its rising in at the vernal equinox in Taurus. On either side of him are Cautes and Cautopates. You see those two little guys with the Phrygian hats and the crossed legs, representatives of the equinoxes. Their legs are crossed. So what does that also tell you about the Saints John, the two parallel lines bordering the circle with the point in the center? There are so many parallels that we could draw to mythology, Mithraism, all the solar and astrological keys, of which there are hundreds of vestiges of the mystery cults if we care to look for them, and ceremonial magic, where that particular configuration, the ox, the lion, the eagle, and the man, is very prominent in ceremonial magic. You'll see it in a ritual as common as what's called the Lesser Ritual of the Pentagram, which is a Golden Dawn ritual. Some people call it the LBRP, or the Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram. The original name is the Lesser Ritual of the Pentagram, and there was both a banishing and an invoking version of that ritual, as you may or may not be aware. And those four creatures, the tetramorph, the four living creatures, are used there. They're used on the banner of the Royal Arch. They're used on the veils. In the, Ephraim, Dan, Reuben, and what's the other? I forget the other one. But the four veils in the Royal Arch each have, one has an ox, one has an eagle, one has a lion, and one has a man. And these are also in the SRICF. You'll see those. The ancients, I don't know if you're a member of the college where you are, but the ancients in that ritualism also correspond not only elementally to those that configuration, but zodiacally as well.
Yeah, I think you have really done a great service to Masonry with this book. And I got to tell everybody out there, even if you are somebody who is not really into the quote-unquote occultism, I think you really owe it to yourself to pick up this book and go through it, because what we're talking about really is well documented. It is plain as day when you look at where things came from, and it sounds like you've just done a world of good in this new book. Where can people get the book?
The best place to get the book is from the Laudable Pursuits website. They're the publisher. Last year, as I said, they put out P.D. Newman's Alchemically Stone. They have a couple other books on their imprint, one by Jason Marshall, who is the main editor over there at the Laudable Pursuit. Matt Anthony does the layout and the artwork. They're both just really great guys who are doing such a service in terms of Masonic thought and letters and carrying quality literature on the craft forward. And I really, really appreciate that they perhaps maybe went out on a limb by sort of co-signing some, as we might say, fringy or occult ideas. But I just don't think they're crazy after taking years of studying this.
Well, they're not crazy, and I'll tell you exactly why they're not really crazy. And that is because there are certain themes within religious and theosophical schools where you can take the story and you can look at it and say, this part's BS, this part's not BS, this is because it's telling a story, they're trying to convey an allegory and teach you a lesson, and where this comes in and who these players are, did they exist, did they not exist, and you can look at these things and you can look at historical documents and you can tell whether or not something is real or not real. And it drives me crazy that today we have some certain religious views which really are proven through historical documentation to be not as accurate as some would claim. And I think that's a shame. And when we look at it, you know, academia looks at these topics and they say, great, this is cool. It's not fringy. It's the way it is. And I think what you've done here, it's only fringy, right? Because it might make some people uncomfortable. And I think, as a famous rabbi said, when you start making yourself uncomfortable, that's when you start to grow. And so pick up the book and grow a little bit. Jamie, thanks so much for coming on the show. This has been fantastic and enlightening. I hope everybody out there who is listening to this program picks up the book and continues to edify themselves within Masonry by checking out Myth, Magic, and Masonry. Again, available at the Laudable Pursuit and other places where you can get some books. I'll put links in the show notes so that everybody can grab the book there. Jamie, any last imparting words that you'd like to convey to our listeners?
I hope that my work inspires Masons to dig a little deeper, not necessarily in the historical and established origins of our craft, what we're able to see, such as the cathedral builders of the Middle Ages, but also the ideas and concepts which come to us from such disparate subjects as solar and astrological symbolism, mythology, classical mythology, and ceremonial magic.
Perfectly said. I couldn't agree with you more. It means so much to me and so many other brothers when we can come together and look at where we've come from, not from a historical perspective, but from that philosophical perspective, which necessarily encompasses the mythology, and looking at where we came from in terms of the origins of our religions and those things that kind of carry through, and we pull that red thread, as we might say. So, Jamie Paul Lamb, thank you so much for coming on the program. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Brother, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview, listening as much as I did, having the opportunity to talk with Brother Jamie Paul Lamb. Again, if you're interested in that book, please head on over to Laudable Pursuits website and pick it up there. I have a copy. Also, phenomenal book. Can't say enough great stuff about it. I think it really speaks to the thesis of the book when we have cited references, which he does. So again, I know you guys heard me talk about that in the interview, but it is important. Really cool stuff. Check it out. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to WCYpodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Contributing $2 a month, $5, or even $10 a month, whatever you choose, really helps the program out. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. Help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Banker's Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Banker's Best Beard and Skin Care. He's been so generous. If you head to WCYpodcast.com, click on More, then click on Banker's Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skin care, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first Grand Master. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Banker's Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code with On It. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to On It, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to onit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and seeing success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out. And that's it, guys. I just want to remind everybody that if you like podcasts, please don't forget about the Masonic Roundtable, which goes live every Tuesday at 10, 9 central. And if you like reading Masonic stuff, You heard me at the top of the show talk about the Midnight Freemasons. Again, check out themidnightfreemasons.com. We publish 3 articles every single week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, perspective pieces from the writers all across the United States and even some abroad. And before we leave, I did want to mention that I guess there was a little bit of a issue if you went over to buybankersdesk.com and tried to add the brand new shave soap that he's created to the cart. It wasn't adding, but he has reassured me that it is all fixed and it's good to go. So once more, check out buybankersdesk.com. Get yourself some great shave soap there. I can't say enough great stuff about Levi Banker and his product. And until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.